Live from Deerbur, this is the Locktoon Podcast. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
Before we begin, as always, we have a few announcements. Firstly, we are planning a few special episodes that we are so stoked about over the next couple of months. We're bringing in a couple of special guests, including a few listeners. If you guys have an idea for a special episode deep dive, for example, religion in the books or Greek and or Roman mythology as it relates to the Locktoon, and you have that expertise, reach out and let us know, because we'd love to have conversations with people who know more than we do about the many different themes in these books.
Secondly, it is holiday season, y'all. Be sure to check out Locktoon Series Creator Hub on our website, where we've listed a bunch of artists and creators who make Locktoon art and merch, along with links to their online stores. Go to locktoonpod.com/fanmerch to get some gifts and support the fan community. If you are a creator and you want us to post your shop on our site, fill out the form on our website and we'll get it up there. And finally, if you want to support the pod, that's Amy and I here and all the work we do at the Locktoon Pod, head to our website to buy stickers, pins, and magnets. You can also, and here's what I am most excited about, order a personalized holiday card, or really a card for any occasion, from us to one of your pals, or many of your pals. That personalized card will include whatever message you want us to relay. Of course, we'll add our own twist, along with a Locktoon Pod joke, just for your bud. And like everything else, you can find that on our website at locktoonpod.com. Thanks to all of you who have already placed your orders and supported us. All the proceeds from our merch sales go back into making this pod as podcastic as we can.
With all of that said, let's get into it. Today we are covering chapters 2 and 3 of Nona the Ninth. In these chapters, we get to know most of our main characters through Nona's eyes as she describes what it's like to live with Pyrrha, Palamedes, and Camilla. And also we learn how she came to be part of this very funny gaggle of youths, her gang. So we got quite a bit to cover.
We sure do. But before we get into chapter 2, Amy, why does Alecto have yellow eyes?
I have no idea. Why?
Because
pull yourself together.
Because she has jaundice.
Oh my God. That was such a dad joke. That was like, wow.
I thought it was really clever. I was really proud of myself. And you know what? I think my jokes aren't really that good. And then our listeners write in and tell me my jokes are good. And I get inspired. And so that's what happened today. Someone wrote in. They were like, your jokes are funny. And I just came up with another really funny joke right away.
All right, guys. You heard it here. Send Mel encouragement so that they can keep on churning out these absolute gems. Mel, you know I love them too.
I know. I mainly just do it for you.
But it's true. You have like major Gideon vibes. Our listeners have pointed this out and it is true.
That's like such a nice compliment. I definitely don't have Gideon's muscles and we'll just leave it at that.
It's not true, you guys. Into chapter 2.
Chapter 2.
This is a really nice bit because that question that we had, who works for Nona? Who looks after Nona? Who teaches Nona? We just get it laid out. So it's Pyrrha worked for Nona, Camilla looked after Nona, and Palamedes taught Nona. Why it is that these are how they're broken out is a bit of a mystery to me.
I think that kind of comes out a little bit later. Remember that we're reading this from Nona's perspective. And so This is how Nona is categorizing these three people in her life. Mm-hmm. Also, we learn immediately why they call her Nona. And what is said here is that when these three saved her and brought her to this planet, the first thing that came out of her mouth was no, no, which then became Nona. Nona means 9, and 9 was an important number. And I'm wondering, why do you think Nona was saying no, no?
I mean, I feel like it was a please don't or oh no situation, right? And so it could either be left over from John putting her Electo in the tomb, or it could be something about the process wherein she and Harrow switched. She could be saying like, no, no, don't switch. I don't know. Something, right. But right, something along those lines.
Yeah. I feel like it might actually, that actually might get called back to you in Electo. Because there's always something in these liminal spaces, right? These like transitions that exist in these books. And there is almost always a callback if there is kind of this gray area of a transition. We almost always get that answered a book or a book and a half later.
That's so true. I also just, you saying that, I don't think the word liminal has been used in this book yet, which is a change.
You know what? I just bought the Kindle version of these books. I have two hardcover Nona books because I accidentally pre-ordered twice because I didn't remember doing it the first time. I have the audiobook. And now I have the Kindle version, which I have found so helpful because I can search for words in it.
Oh, yeah.
Let me tell you, that has been amazing. But I just searched liminal, and you're right. The word liminal does not show up in Nona at all.
Wow. I feel like this is probably the biggest revelation that we as a podcast could reveal about this book. After about 50,000 liminals and Harrow.
That's my next search. Yeah. Anyway, we digress.
we do.
So, you know, what we're learning in this chapter at first is like a little bit more about Nona. It's all like very lighthearted for the most part. She explains that she's probably one of two people, right? Basically, all the questions that we're wondering about, like, do get answered for the most part right away. So it's unclear which of the two people she is, but it is definitely clear that her body is one of these two people. And she thinks she's a hottie. And she like macks on herself. And Camilla writes about it. And it's cute because Harrow has never shown herself love in all these books. And Nona gets to show Harrow's body some self-love here. And it's nice.
Yeah, it's also interesting because we talk about how it's obvious that Ianthe thinks that Harrow's weirdly hot and Gideon, I think, also. But it's kind of confirmed in this bit that Harrow is, in her own way, an attractive person. I feel like probably especially without the paint.
She's definitely a hottie. And you don't need anyone else to validate for you that you are a hottie. But mm-hmm. just in case there was any question, right? Even later on in this chapter, Nona talks about how everyone else thinks she's hot, too. She gets these weird interactions with weird men.
Classic.
So, you know, Harrow's body is a hottie.
It's true. I think that this was also the moment, correct me if I'm wrong, where I think this was fairly obvious that it was Harrow, that it was Harrow's body.
Yeah, there's some like description.
Right.
That her hair was, I think, the color of a burnt out bottom of a pan. Mm-hmm. She has a pointed face, pointed chin. Like it's definitely Harrow's body without question.
Right. It goes on to say that Nona has the yellow eyes. Just to be completely sure, the eyes that Nona has are because it's Electo in the body, or is it Gideon's eyes and like a weird twist up?
I think it's left to be a little bit ambiguous. Mm-hmm. I mean, we kind of deduce by the end of the book for some of us right away that it is Electo in Harrow's body for the most part. But we also know that there is a part of Gideon's soul that is in Harrow, even when Kiriona comes in later. And so it's kind of reminiscent of in Harrow, we couldn't really tell who the body was. Like for me, I always thought the body could be Gideon or it could be someone else. Mm-hmm. And here that kind of is showing up again. I think that my theory is that Nona's yellow eyes are because Nona is Electo. But it's not clear.
That's probably the simplest theory. I do feel like with these books, like sometimes we try and really look into it, but often the simplest explanation is what Because Tamsin Muir is a good writer, and like good writers don't overly complicate things, you know. Yeah. It's a mystery and there are like a lot of moving pieces.
Yeah, arguably Harrow is like an overcomplicated book, but I like that. There was some tweet thread that was happening on our Twitter at one point, and I think someone said something like, overcomplicating things is really gay. And I was like, yeah, sure, okay. I mean, I'm sure the straights also overcomplicate things, but I do think there is like an even greater tendency for the gays to really go hard on the overcomplication.
Yeah, for sure.
But again, I digress. All that said, we are validated in that the I thing is confusing, because when Nona is asking Palamedes like the reason why all their eyes belong to other people, he gives a straightforward answer. Something like, you know, when you give yourself to someone else, their soul shows up in you by the eye color. She then follows up with another question, and Palamedes is like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's not always super straightforward.
Right. This is the part of the book where we really start to learn that Nona has this gift of being able to recognize what people mean, like truly mean. There's this bit following this description of Nona's features, validating Asmel was saying that some other people think that she's attractive too. And she's talking to this guy in line who is really coming on to her. And it's funny because I feel like as sensual and like sexy as these books can be between characters, there isn't a lot of like acknowledgement. But Nona's just like, oh, that guy was talking to me. Because it was a sex thing. He wanted to have sex with me. And Camilla's like, whoa.
Totally. I think Nona's also like, yeah, he wanted to see me naked. Mm-hmm. I feel like also the word sex does not show up in either Gideon the Ninth or Harrow the Ninth. I feel like this is the first sex that is even explicitly.
No, I feel like Ianthe says, you know, for sex things.
Oh, you're
for
right.
For sex
okay.
reasons.
Once. Yeah. You're right. But anyway, you're right. But it's not usually called out this explicitly. And it's funny, Nona's not making a big deal out of it, but Camilla, like, cannot even hear the word sex.
I know, she freaks out.
But I think Camilla says something like when Nona and Camilla are having this conversation about it's a sex thing, Camilla says something like, it's bad enough, you know, that she had to help Nona in the bath.
Yeah. Which,
what is that about?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like it must be a weird thing for them because it's Harrow who is, you know, Harrow. But also Nona has become almost like a sister or a child. The relationship is not clear. And like many relationships in these books, it's just, I can understand that it would be uncomfortable. And it's also Camilla who is like,
right.
Kind of above it.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, totally. Anyway, Camilla continues to write down all these notes. So basically anything that is happening to Nona, anything that Nona says, Camilla and Palamedes are writing down. Mm-hmm. And so it's just kind of this constant, I don't know if I would call it surveillance, but sort of, where, you know, Nona never really has a moment to herself that people aren't like analyzing her. And that definitely doesn't go unnoticed by Nona.
Right.
The rest of the chapter pretty much does a rundown on the profiles of each member of this gay little household.
Mm-hmm. It starts with Eurydice, who Mel's note is big daddy energy. Truly, though. She's good with her hands. She has...
Yeah, she is.
Jesus. She kind of runs the house. I do think it's an interesting callback about like how Pyrrha smokes cigs. And we remember that Augustine said he started a smoking habit for Pyrrha, one that he held on to for 10,000 years.
Yeah.
And she's good with a gun and good with a sword. So she's kind of just like a sexy badass.
Yeah. Pyrrha's hot. We've said it before. We'll say it again.
Yeah.
Definitely big daddy energy, kind of like takes care of the house and runs the house and, you know, is sort of like in charge. They all play their different roles, but Pyrrha's, you know, has 10,000 years of life experience. So you know, generally knows what she's doing, although not infallible.
Definitely not. I also feel like, obviously, Hiroteve is not a trans character in, like, the way, but is a genderqueer. Like, the way that it's presented, I've always felt is very, it doesn't really go into, like, how she feels being in a different body than what, you know, was her body. But she also doesn't ever seem, I don't know, it's complicated, but I think it's a very, like, genderqueer sort of vibe coming from Pyrrha.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's why I said big daddy energy. Pyrrha uses she, her pronouns in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to remember that Pyrrha's in Gideon's body.
Right.
Gideon the First. And so, yeah, I would say, like, very genderqueer. I really relate to Pyrrha's kind of the queer vibes of Pyrrha. Although I don't do guns and I'm never picked up a sword in my life. But
Camilla Hecht, according to Nona, can fight with anything, which I believe.
Hell yeah.
She has this beautiful little smile. I like the description of her telling the drunk man at the bottom of the hall that none of them like it when he hit his partner and then that guy moves out.
Yeah, that like really warmed my heart. I was like, wow, what would it be like if, oh, yeah, that was just so good.
We've got another sexy badass in the house.
Yes. And there's a lot more, you know, that we see about Camilla, according to Nona, like later on in the book. But mm-hmm. Nona obviously has like a major admiration for Camilla. And then the only thing that Nona says about Palamedes in this chapter is that he can think. And so it's interesting because there's this like very long description of Pyrrha. There's a, you know, a slightly shorter description of Camilla. And then there's just like Palamedes can think. He says that's his party trick. And, you know, throughout this chapter and the next, we also learn that, like, Palamedes never makes Nona feel bad about anything mm-hmm. she can't do. And I think in the last chapter or something, he always asks for permission, asks for consent, even if he knows what the answer is going to be. And so he's just, you know, he's Palamedes. He hasn't changed.
Yeah, not at all. I feel like Nona kind of has favorites. Like, she loves Palamedes, but she really loves Cam. And she also really loves Pyrrha, but, like, I feel like Cam's the favorite, right?
Cam's definitely. I think I'm probably going to get shit for this, but but I feel like Pal and Cam give mom and dad vibes.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking, like, traditional Western gendered roles,
mm-hmm.
like, Nona goes to Palamedes when Camilla says no. You know, it's like that, like, classic weird dynamic. And Palamedes is, you know, definitely more malleable. I feel like Camilla doesn't change her mind unless she talks to Palamedes.
Right.
And he convinces her otherwise. So there's definitely that kind of, like, parental-ish dynamic going on.
Definitely.
But all of this, all these profiles of everyone is told within the context of Nona, like, really feeling like she's not really contributing at all to society or to the household. It took her a while to figure out how to use her body. Right. She can't shoot or fight. She says, and I appreciate this line, she says, all she had was a good nature,
mm-hmm.
which, to be honest, is such a value add that is so underrated in the world. It's like such a rare thing, you know, for someone to have a good nature, even though it says here that wasn't true all the time. She has a bad temper. She's thrown these tantrums. So here are the tantrums coming up again, which is more foreshadowing.
Yeah, we definitely get so many. We're going to see a tantrum moments in these first couple of chapters. I feel like this is also where, you know, I was looking for these signs, but when I read that she couldn't do the bone stuff and she wasn't interested in swords, I was just like, it can't really, I just feel like it would be a weird way to write this if it was Hera or it was Gideon or a mix and have them totally uninterested in the things that those people were most interested in. So it is a big hint that this is actually not Hera or Gideon.
Yeah, it's funny because my basic mind was like, she doesn't know any of this stuff because she has amnesia, you know, like, I mean, I get that it's a big hint, but I still really was convinced that, oh, at some point, everything's going to come flowing back to her.
Well, to be fair, she doesn't know any of this stuff because she does have amnesia. Because at the end of the day, we do learn that Electo can wield a sword.
Yes.
But right. That's not because she's Gideon.
Right. Totally. Yeah. We will talk about this more towards the end of the book, but there is some compartmentalizing that Electo is doing, or that Nona is doing, so that she doesn't actually lean hard into her true and full identity as Electo here.
Right, because she ends up knowing a lot more than it seems in these first couple chapters.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, Nona's real down on herself that she can't contribute to the household and to society in the same way that the rest of her found fam can. But what she can do is, and what she is good at, right, is not only having a good nature, but like actually providing touch to people. And it sounds like the household has transformed, right, from the people who we knew before. When they're around Nona, Pyrrha ruffles her head, you know, and scoops her up and hugs her, and Palamides pulls blankets up over her and tucks her in, and Camilla will hold her hand. And it's all these small little intimate touches that are happening that we actually don't see a ton of in these books. And you know, Harrow is really not into touch. And so I'm really curious, you know, I wonder how Harrow would feel about all the touching that is happening, right, with her body. But it's Nona who is inhabiting it. And I've been thinking about how, like, Harrow was really denied any sort of, like, touching as a child.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't get hugs from her family. And so it's almost like Harrow's body is getting to experience the kind of loving touch that she never had. But I do wonder how she would feel about that, or if that's even going to come up, you know, when she does get her body back. And if any of that memory will live in the body for her.
Yeah, no, I think, well, you know, our bodies, even though they're just kind of meat suits, do remember trauma and inversely remember good shit that we've been through. And I think, yeah, I think it's got to kind of like live in the body a little bit. Yeah. I'm hoping that we'll see a more cuddly Harrow.
We can only hope for that. Also, it is cute and it makes sense that the soul of the earth would love touch. You know, that would be one of their love languages.
Yeah.
So it's just a cute touch.
Mm-hmm. It's funny what Nona thinks that she can do. I like that she can do the carpet. She can rub the carpet in a way that can get the hair out of it.
Yeah. Which is funny.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the most interesting thing for us that we learn in this chapter is the language thing.
Really? I thought it was that she's good at wiping dishes.
I mean, that was kind of huge.
But yeah, definitely the language thing. It's both very interesting to us, the reader. It also completely confounds Palamides,
right,
and confuses the whole household. And it's really cool how Tamsin Muir dreamt up this way of Nona being able to know all the languages.
Yeah, it has a good use in the plot as well as it making sense for the character.
Yeah, basically the way it works is that it's not like Nona just can inherently just knows all the languages. When someone speaks to her in their language and she sees how their body and their lips move, she's able to then speak back to that person in the same language. She can do this with any language.
Mm-hmm.
To me, of all the clues that this is Electo, this is the one that I think really put me on track to understand what was happening here.
Right, because it's not even like, oh yeah, that sounds like Electo. It's just like, that is not Gideon or Harrow, you know?
Right. Like, what could this possibly be?
Yeah.
Like, we all know Gideon doesn't know a bunch of languages.
Yeah.
They've interacted with two people in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense that the Earth would know all the languages.
Right.
We also learn regarding language that, right, Pyrrha, Pal, and Cam speak house. And that's what on this planet is used for what Nona calls business transactions. But I love the description of house as a language and that it's falling out of favor because it was a language used by awful people.
Mm-hmm. I assume this is English?
I mean, whatever. Maybe that's really...
Like, John is from New Zealand.
Right,
and I mean, it's either...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Totally. Totally.
And I do think it's interesting because English is also, right now, the language of colonizers.
Yeah. So it tracks.
Mm-hmm.
It really tracks. And so, like, zooming out, you know, we close with... You know, Tamsin Muir, as always, weaves in context throughout these books.
Yeah.
So there is more exposition, right, in Nona than there is in any of the other two books.
Mm-hmm.
And we still get a lot of that, like, weaving in of, like, context clues, right?
Right.
And so we learn, right, there's a lot of different languages on this planet because there are refugees from other planets because of the resettlements.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a little bit about this, I think, last episode. But basically, all these people are getting resettled on planets that are somewhat livable. And here we find out that there are only three planets that people are getting resettled on. Which is wild,
yeah.
When you think about how much of the universe has been covered by mm-hmm. John's kind of expansion. But, right, they're killing off all these planets. So there are three left that are habitable, supposedly.
Right.
And then we also learn, right, that there's, like, and we got a sense of this in the first couple chapter, or the first chapter, but people are not into necromancers here.
Mm-mm.
And it's at the point where... Palamity's rule for the household is that no one is allowed to say the word zombies, necromancer, or necromancy at any point. Zombies is a derogatory term for a necromancer. But despite all of the turmoil happening on the planet, the chapter closes with Nona just being, like, so happy to be here and living this life. And timeline-wise, this has been her life basically for the past 6 months. So as we move into chapter three... The buildup of chapter three is basically understanding how Nona came to work at the school, and then we get to meet all the friends that Nona makes. So this is also another light-ish chapter.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'll point out just when the chapter opens is that when Nona asks Camilla how she comes across to other people, Camilla responds and says, unworldly.
Yeah.
Which I think is hilarious because Nona is the world.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That's really funny. We get a little bit more information about where they live. I think it's interesting because I don't really understand what this building is. They live in this building. It's surrounded by a couple other buildings. And then one of the buildings is a school. I think the building behind them. And the building that Nona lives in, later her friends tell her it's banned.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And we can talk about this when we get to whatever chapter it shows up in. I'm pretty sure it's a Blood of Eden structure. Like, I think it's like one of the buildings where a lot of Blood of Eden people live.
Yeah, or almost like witness protection. Like, they put people who are like... Yeah.
It's definitely related to Blood of Eden because there's some sort of dialogue with the messenger and Pash and maybe even We Suffer. I can't remember. It'll come up. But it's definitely this, like, building that, you know, when Nona encounters this nice lady teacher who works at the school that's behind them, she's kind of like, she kind of like raises her eyebrows at the fact that Nona lives in, quote unquote, the building.
Yeah, there's something about it. But this teacher does show up and tells Kira and Camilla that Nona should go to school. They have this whole conversation that we won't really go into, but it basically ends up with Pyrrha and Camilla saying that Nona can't go to school, even though Nona is very keen. And Nona recognizes in this, because it's kind of a weird situation, right? There's this big burly dude and these two women, and it seems like, according to this teacher, that Nona looks like she's like 14 years old. Which is funny. But Kira is able to kind of divert suspicion by playing it off as if she is the pimp and Nona and Cam are working girls, as she says. But later, Kira tells Nona that she actually can go to school and be a teacher's aide. And Nona asks her why she flirted with the teacher, even though she didn't like her. And this is just another moment where we see how perceptive Nona is. And Kira explains that she was kind of trying to cover for them and flirted with her to kind of seem more like a pimp. And
I don't think Kira ever actually says that, though. But I think we can like deduce that that's what was happening.
Yeah, you're right. But I mean, that's pretty obviously what was happening. Right?
That's what's going on.
But Kira does explain what had happened, because that's the incredible line where Nona says, "What's pimp?"
Right. What's pimp? Oh my God, it's so good.
Oh my God.
It's so good. And so, like, after all of that, you know, Nona is able to go to school. There's a cover story. I find the cover story, like, this is, again, another example of weaving in context without just saying anything explicitly. But, like, her cover story is basically that she's living with her sister, who is Cam, and a friend of her father's, who is Pira, and that everyone else is dead. And the way that Tamsin describes this story as, like, so ordinary and boring. And so it just gives you a picture of the kind of world that they are all living in yeah. right now, that this is such a typical story. It's such a dire place and situation that everyone is in.
Right.
But Nona goes to school. She helps out with really general, basic tasks. The teacher, you know, accepts that she can't really teach her anything. And of course, Nona's most fun task is taking care of none other than Noodle, the science teacher's dog. And Noodle's described as a dirty white creature with six legs and a gentle disposition.
You better believe that I'm naming my future dog Noodle.
Totally. I wonder how many Locktoom fans have named their dogs Noodle since Nona came out. It's funny because one of my friends pointed out to me that in our reaction episode, like, we didn't mention Noodle at all mm-hmm. and thought this was like a major oversight.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, you're right. I guess I mean, there was a lot to like talk about, but you're right. We did leave Noodle out, and Noodle deserves a little bit of time.
No, Noodle's on the damn cover.
I know. Noodle's very important. I think my theory, and I share this with the friend who called me out for this shit, is that Noodle is going to be very important in Electo. That is based on very little, I think. Mm-hmm. Except in the end, when Noodle really does play a role, Noodle's existence is the reason why Paul and everyone survived. So, you know, I think Noodle's important. It's also, you know, Noodle is the angel's dog, right? And we know that the angel is a very important character. So, you know, let's not overlook Noodle again.
Yeah. On the subject of the angel, this is the hour of science teacher, who seems to be kind of like a very normal person. And I felt like because of the amount of time they were giving to describing her, I was like, this person must be important. But I was also like, this person seems so normal.
Yeah.
There was nothing and is nothing. Like, throughout the entire thing, even when she becomes important, there's nothing about her that seems important. And maybe that's the point. But
I think that's the point.
She's a very nice, even-keeled, sort of kind person.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, very yeah. rare in itself.
And, you know, skipping ahead a little bit, Nona is approached by one of these, a kid named Honesty, and is told that Hot Sauce wants to see her. Mm-hmm. And so we learn a little bit about, like, who Hot Sauce is. And this, like, little group of kids who kind of run the school. They're like the cool, mysterious kids. And then you get to know them and they're not so cool or so mysterious, with the exception of Hot Sauce. But we find out that the reason that these kids want to be friends with Nona is one, at first they say like, oh, you're old and you can get us drugs. Yeah. Also, you live in the building.
Yeah.
And we want to see the room where they keep the bodies there. And Nona's like, ugh, I can't get you drugs. And I don't know about a secret room with bodies, so I can't do that for you. Mm-hmm. And they're disappointed, and she's worried that they're going to not accept her. But Hot Sauce, who is like the leader, is basically like, well, Nona gets to talk to the angel and look after Noodle. So Nona's in the group. And we find out that these kids are like obsessed with the science teacher. And it turns out like all of the kids really idolize the teacher. I think the line is that she's calm and even-handed and the same day in and day out. And so if we put together the clues, the context clues around like what kind of chaotic world these kids are living in.
Right.
Of course, they're obsessed with the angel. The angel is stability.
Right.
You know?
I also think that there's a moment that it's implied that Hot Sauce might have gotten into trouble at some point and like had to go and see the angel who fixed her mm-hmm. up, right?
Right, yeah.
So might I also, like, that's an addition. You know, the angel literally took care of her when she was hurt or something had happened. But we can get to that when we actually read that section.
Yeah. You want to talk through the squad?
Yeah. Yeah, the angel will definitely be major something in Electo.
Yeah.
Major something. So the squad, Nona starts hanging out with this group of kids in the school, and she names them as Hot Sauce, Honesty, Beautiful Ruby, Born in the Morning, and Kevin. And a listener wrote in, thanks for writing in, Joanna. And Joanna said, my hot take on Nona is that the kids' names are just their meanings. And I've seen this on social media. I think that this is probably definitely true. So what this means is basically because Nona translates everything into what I think is English, I think she's probably hearing names that mean things in whatever languages those names like originate in and is translating them directly for this narration. And I've heard like many different explanations for Kevin. I think it's probably just that Kevin is Kevin, like it's said in English.
Yeah.
And the rest of them are not typical English names, right?
Right.
But anyway, yeah, Joanna wanted to know our take on their names and also in relation to the names of Blood of Eden, which is also another interesting. I don't know if they're related.
Well, I don't know that we actually have that answer. I will give my opinion. And that is that the kids aren't really, I don't think any of these kids are actually part of Blood of Eden. In fact, I'm pretty sure that Born in the Morning's five fathers are part of an even more radical group.
Right.
That is forming because they don't actually think Blood of Eden is doing enough. I don't think they're related to Blood of Eden. I could be wrong. I think Hot Sauce's name is Hot Sauce. I think Hot Sauce named herself Hot Sauce. I don't think that one's a translation. One of my favorite things that I saw on the Twitter at one point was that Honesty was actually Frank, which I don't think that, like, I don't know if that's true, right? Because if we're saying that this is maybe languages that aren't English being translated into English, like Frank and Honesty are both English words.
Yeah, they're also like literally a thousand. I was like looking at names that meant these things. There are a thousand things that could translate into Honesty. Born in the Morning is like also like there are many different names that could mean Born in the Morning. Beautiful Ruby, I wasn't completely sure, but I feel like it's probably like
I was looking into that. It's like 10 gazillion different combinations of things. But I just loved the hot take that Honesty was Frank. I thought that was hilarious. So kudos.
Honestly, if Kevin wasn't in the mix, I would be like, absolutely. But I feel like this is the what's happening is that Kevin is just Kevin.
It's just Kevin. Just Kevin.
Yeah, because Kevin just means Kevin. Something. I don't know what Kevin means, but
does it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Something in Latin.
Who knows? That's a special episode, folks.
Yeah, if you are a Latin expert, write us.
But I also feel like Hot Sauce could be any variety of hot sauce. Although, well, I don't know. I was like, maybe
Frank's Red Hot. Oh my God, I just found the through line between three of them. Okay. Honesty is Frank. Hot sauce, Frank's Red Hot. Beautiful Ruby, rubies are red. This whole squad is Frank's Red Hot. Anyway.
Wow.
I don't know where Born in the Morning or Kevin fit in, but.
Well, Kevin's just Kevin.
Kevin's just Kevin. Okay. Anyway, this is the squad.
Thank you for writing in, Joanna. I mean, I don't know if we can answer your Blood of Eden question, but definitely I think that this is a pretty good take. The kids are not actually named this, especially because I think Palamedes is like, is his name really Honesty? And she's like, right. That's how I hear it. I think that's a pretty good hint.
So squad goals here. We got Hot Sauce. Hot Sauce is the leader. Oldest child at 14, which, by the way, is the same age, I think, as Jean-Marie and Isaac, which
Whoa.
Is just kind of weird to think about. Hot Sauce is also covered in burns and, according to Nona, got to hold a gun in a war, which, you know, who knows the actual details. This could be myth, but definitely covered in burns. Kind of every time there's a new person that comes to the school, they get brought to Hot Sauce. Hot Sauce shows them her burns. It's supposed to, like, you know, scare them or make them revere her, whatever. We also learn that Hot Sauce doesn't have parents.
Right.
Then there's Honesty, who's the kind of second in command. Honesty is like hilarious, is like a hustler, buys and sells drugs. I think he's like 12.
I think he gets them to sell, right?
Yeah, buys and sells drugs.
Oh, I thought you said buys himself drugs. I was like, damn, no. Okay, that's a dark read.
That was just me lisping. The funny thing is that Honesty tells major lies,
yeah.
Which, as we know, like, Nona can basically just calls out all the lies that Honesty tells. Beautiful Ruby, the only thing we really know about Beautiful Ruby is that Beautiful Ruby has a mom and the mom has a new baby.
Mm-hmm.
I love that Born in the Morning has five dads and their names are like really funny.
Yeah.
Which again, maybe is just Nona. I don't know. Eldest father, second eldest father, brother father, younger brother father, and new father.
Uh-huh.
What do we think about all these daddies?
I don't know. I think it's just gay.
You think it's gay? See, I think some of it is gay and then some of it is just like kind of extended family.
I don't think they're all in like a giant poly relationship. No, I think it's like she has
queer.
Older brothers and probably like two or three dads. Yeah, they're just all dads.
Yeah, they all like take care of Born in the Morning. Finally, Kevin is 7. That's what we know about Kevin. Kevin is 7.
Right. It's interesting because when Nona is interacting with Honesty, she has a hard time lying. And it says that she really wanted to lie, but she didn't know how to. And it's interesting because that is a callback that Augustine says, even after 2 centuries, my lord, you told us the truth about Annabelle, about Alecto, because she knew the truth about it too, and you never could control her. Even after 2 centuries, I'm not sure she ever managed to lie.
Bada bing, bada boom. Yeah, Nona can't lie.
Mm-mm. And we get to learn a little bit about what the kids do together, which is pretty much nothing. But one is interesting thing that they do when they're just sitting around, just kind of loitering and hanging out, is they hear this thing pass. There are underground tunnels. I assume it's like subway tunnels, right?
Yeah.
And they hear these rumbles going through these underground tunnels under the city. And when there's a particularly large rumble, they say it's the convoy. And the convoy is, as Pyrrha describes later, a convoy is a sort of a group of large vehicles moving in a line. But they have this sort of like superstitious ghost story belief about the convoy. And I don't know how they would have gotten the information about the convoy, but they somehow know that it is, because it is, it's literally a convoy. It's a group of mega trucks driving underground.
Right. And we know the convoy really is driving the sixth house around.
Right.
But that doesn't come up. Like, you know, we know the convoy is going to come up later, mm-hmm. because they it's made such a big deal of here.
Right.
I find it interesting that there's this line in this chapter that says Nona gets some good ticklish vibes from the convoy. What is up with the ticklish vibes? Is it just the vibration of the earth? It's like, it says she never quite got over that little shake, that tight vibration of the stomach when the convoy was near, how it excited her somehow. It was like she could feel something wonderful in it. Is she sensing the sixth house necromancers, or is it just the vibration kind of reminds her of being earth?
Interesting. I thought it was something about necromancy, that she could sense a large amount of necromancy.
Yeah. It's just curious that she says it feels like something wonderful, because I can't remember if it was in the last two chapters or if it's after this, but she says that when Palamedes does necromancy, it kind of makes her sad that he can do it.
Right.
And so I don't know like how she feels towards it, but
maybe it reminds her of John.
Yeah, maybe.
Because, I mean, presumably she, as the entirety of Earth, was the entity that first gave John his necromantic powers.
Right.
Well, anyway, if you guys have thoughts, let us know.
Let us know. But to start to close out the chapter, I think that another like big takeaway from this chapter is that all these kids, all the Squad Goals kids, they hate necromancers and necromancy. And they talk about in really flippant ways of killing zombies, right? Mm-hmm. Killing necromancers. And I think Born in the Morning even tells a story about how he threw a rock at a necromancer and the necromancer died.
Right.
Then they get into this big argument about if the rock actually killed the necromancer, because the necromancer was already on fire and in a cage. And it's just a bunch of kids talking about really gruesome shit and it not really processing it as gruesome.
Yeah.
It's kind of like how we're all desensitized to a bunch of horrible things. It's kind of what's happening here. But this is a really gruesome picture that they are painting.
It really is. And this is also going to be, we're going to come back to this when later on, Kira and Camilla and Palamedes have this sort of fight over people capture more, quote unquote, necromancers and take them to the park to be burned. And that's what these kids are talking about here, is that they take necromancers to these cages in the park and burn them alive. And yeah, and these kids are growing up in a war zone and, you know, it's awful. We then have beautiful Ruby ask about Varun. Is this the first time we hear Varun?
Yeah. So Varun the Eater, this is number 7.
The Resurrection Beast.
The Resurrection Beast. Yeah, Varun the Eater. In the book, beautiful Ruby asks Hot Sauce, what about Varun the Eater? And Hot Sauce says it's here for them. So basically, like, Varun the Eater, this Resurrection Beast, is here for the necromancers. And we had a question come in from Claire, and I've seen some other, like, thoughts around this. I did a little bit of my own research, but Claire wrote in and asked if we had any theories on why everyone calls number 7 Varun. And here's where I landed on this. So I've seen a little bit on Reddit that people think that Varun means Uranus, but actually Varun is derived from the name Varuna, who in the Hindi faith was the god of war, and it also means Neptune. And so the confusion here is that people think, oh, Varun is Uranus because it's number 7 and Uranus is the 7th planet.
Mm-hmm.
However, here's my hot take. The reason Varun is number 7 is because number 7 is actually like the 7th resurrection beast if you don't count Earth. And so Neptune is the 8th planet from the sun in the solar system. But when Jod describes how he killed off all the planets in John 1:20 later in the book, he describes taking, I think, like Mercury and Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and then Neptune.
Right.
And he doesn't really kill Earth. He like takes Earth's soul and he puts it in himself in an Electo, but he straight up kills the other planets. And Neptune is the 7th planet that he kills.
Mm-hmm.
Pluto's number 8. And so Varun the Eater is number 7 and does mean Neptune. And just, you know, as a fun fact, Uranus is actually a rune in Hindi.
Do they go in order?
They do go in order. I looked this up in John 1:20. Actually, here's the order that John describes. He says he sliced through Venus and Mercury and Mars, then killed Jupiter, Saturn, then went after Uranus and Neptune, and then Pluto. And so Venus and Mercury are like switched in the order. Yeah. So Venus is probably one and Mercury is two, which makes sense because he's extending out from Earth. So he's going in one direction, knocking off Venus and Mercury, then the other direction.
So it's just how far they are from Earth.
Yeah, I think so.
Ah. Okay, cool.
But I don't think I'm the first one to, like, name that. I'm sure it's in other places, but...
That's pretty epic.
Claire, thank you for writing in and letting me go down this rabbit hole. That was fun.
Yeah. Oof. So, yeah, that's the first reference we have to Varun the Eater. And Hot Sauce says it's here for them, and them being necromancers. And this is the thing that's turning the sky blue. So... When Nona says earlier that the sky had used to be the color of her eyes and now it's not, it's because Varun showed up and has turned the sky blue. Although, as is discussed in earlier in Harrow, Varun actually can't be that close because it would fuck up the gravitational pull like crazy.
Right.
And I like the like science fiction writer in Tamsin Muir who like recognized that.
Totally.
We get a final conversation between Hot Sauce and Nona where Hot Sauce asks Nona if Nona likes it here. And Nona says, I love it here. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. And Hot Sauce says, you're sweet. Which is just when Myra Quirk reads this bit in the books, it's really super well done too.
Yeah.
Because yeah, Hot Sauce is just a kid and like has been so deeply damaged, but I think is really kind of in awe of Nona in a weird way. Just like, how are you still happy in this hellscape?
Totally. Man, yeah, to be 14 and that jaded. It's sad how this closes because Nona says here, well, you know what? If Hot Sauce says I'm sweet, then like I'm in the gang forever. There's nothing that's going to kick me out of this, which doesn't actually turn out to be true in the end. I mean, in the end it does, but they go through their pains.
Yeah. And that's the end of chapter four.
Yeah. You know, this chapter once again ends with Nona just like loving her life, you know?
I know. It's
cute. Yeah, that's it. You know, we thought we wouldn't have much to talk about. And yet here we are.
Just one more audience question. We're going to try and do maybe like one question or theory at the end of each episode if we can. I really liked this comment from Hannah who wrote in saying that in reference to the search and recovery mission that Palantir are talking about in last episode, I think it's chapter one. And Hannah says, what if this is referring to the rest of Pal's bones? In Harrow, Cam talks about how they took his body and I don't know where it is, and how necessary it is to have the second body to be alive for Pal's idea of symbiotic lictorhood. Well, I thought, first of all, that they... When she says they took his body, I thought that was the Nine Houses, because I think that in Harrow, Jod does have some remnants of Blamides, but I'm not sure about that. But it could refer to that either way. I hadn't thought about this, and I don't necessarily know if that's what it is, but I thought it was a really interesting new thought. I just hadn't even thought that could be what it was referring to. And it also made me think like maybe the search and recovery mission had something to do with Gideon's body.
Yeah.
I was thinking that it had something to do with the sixth house, which it might, but yeah.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of things missing that they are in search of.
Yeah.
Right.
True.
And there's like Palamity's bones. There's Harrow's soul, Gideon's soul, Gideon's body, the sixth house, you know. But I really like that take.
Yeah, me too.
And I think it's one of those things, too, that like maybe we'll never know. And that's fine. And it's fun to just speculate and try and puzzle it together.
Yeah, definitely. So, Hannah, thanks for writing it. And also thank you for saying that Ordis is underrated and Pyrrha can step on me because Yeah. I feel like Hannah and I could be friends.
That made me LOL. I was like, yeah, Pyrrha can step on me too.
Pyrrha can step on the entire fandom.
Yeah.
And we'd all say, thank you, Pyrrha. Yes. All right. Well, let's wrap it up for today. Thanks for joining us. If you have questions or comments or want to point out something that we missed, send us a question on our website, LockTombPod.com, or on Twitter at LockTombPod. If you liked this podcast, tell your friends to listen or rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks as always to Olivia Kay for our theme music. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
And we'll see you next time here at the Locked Tomb Podcast.